in your experience at Grand Lab, how much input was there of military needs, specific military needs, into the planning of projects at Rad Lab?
Well, I won't speak for the Rad Lab as a whole. The experiences in the airborne stuff, the Army Air Corps, I have to call it that, were quite different. There were a lot of bright generals in the Army Air Corps, like Pete Quesada, who helped establish requirements. There was no such leadership in the higher elements of the Army. And one of the problems, and a very serious problem, was that there was practically no one in the Army cleared to have access to radar. It may sound crazy to you, but when the war broke out, for example, and the Rad Lab had developed the SCR 582, which I had nothing to do. It turned out it was a very good success. The next generation was SCR 682, and by that time the lab was more, Rad Lab was more formal and more formally organized, and it was transferred to my division as being an Army radar. But let me point out that in 1940, the requirements for fortifications and seacoast artillery was done by a fortifications board consisted of overage colonels who were still living in the 19th, 18th century. They knew all about revetments, how to pour concrete, and about disappearing 12-inch rifles. Not one of them was cleared for radar. So they didn't know what to do about it. About halfway through the war, Ed Bowles, who had established his reputation and had obtained the confidence of Secretary Stimson, had brought into his office some assistants from Rad Lab people. One of the full-time people was David Griggs in the airborne stuff. And he invited me, and I served as special assistant to Secretary Stimson for Army radar. And I would go to Fort Monroe, and I would say, well, we got to write a letter starting this requirement process. So I would sit down with him, help him write the letter. Then that would be addressed to the Army Ground Forces headquarters at Washington, which is now Fort Myers. So then I would go to there, and I would meet with General Dean, who was then the Director of Requirements, and we'd go over the letter that came from Coast Utility Board, and we'd help draft a reply to that. I would help. So eventually it came through the system, even though a lot of, if you just let it go by itself, it would have gotten in the hands of people who weren't cleared for radar, wouldn't know what to do with it, so they put it from that side of the desk to this side of the desk. You don't like to admit in the Army that you don't know. So, and there were a number of conferences where I just deliberately, as special assistant to the Secretary of War, Stimson called meetings. And I had different branches of the Army all meet in the same room. I'd lay out the problems and get their views and then get their agreement. Then we'd write a letter and everybody signed it. Unorthodox as hell. When organizations get as big as the Army and people keep shifting and security tends to take control to the point where people don't know what's going on, there has to be some lubricant or a few drops of oil or something to make the system go. And Ed Bowles supplied that. And in the case of the Army, I did that not as a member of the Rad Lab, but as Stimson's representative, with letters to General Myers and General Dean that Ed Bowles wrote. He was a very good letter writer. And I got full support and cooperation. This was towards the end of the war rather than the beginning. But that was essential to make the flow of the developments that were going on in the Rad Lab expedited into that kind of a big organization. Now, the Air Corps was different. The Air Corps was perfectly willing to take 10 sets, try them out, or bomb take 10 sets down the Caribbean and try to see if they could detect the German submarines, which were going all around the Caribbean. But the Army doesn't do things that way. The Army is table of basic allowances, tables of basic organizations and regulations. Okay? You train people by the tens of thousands.
Mm-hmm.